Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Bienvenidos a todos. My name is Miroslava Chavez Garcia, and I'm the chair of the Chicana and Chicano Studies Department here at UC Davis. And first of all, I wanted to thank everybody who was involved in helping to put this together, organizing, thinking about it, attending, doing every tiny bit of work to do this. It was a lot of effort, group effort. I'm very, very grateful. And the specific folks are listed in the agenda, so please take a look at who they are, but they will be here around today. We're delighted to see everyone here today to discuss our need to overcome the invisibility of Chicana and Chicano, Latina and Latino students in higher education. Today we are concerned particularly with the retention of Chicano and Latino students at UC Davis and in higher education more broadly. This event came together as a result of a few of us talking about the increasingly dire situation of Chicano and Latino students on this campus. We lamented the budget cuts, the retirement of key staff working with Chicano and Latino students, and the elimination of important centers, programs, and funding sources for students. We wondered how we in Chicano Studies might bring more attention to this increasingly difficult situation. As we pulled more colleagues together to study the issues more in depth, we wondered about the kinds of concrete strategies we might develop to address the growing problem of attrition, specifically among Chicano and Latino students, a trend few of us on this campus like to talk about. We believe that we need not only to discuss the matter, but also to find viable strategies for reaching out to students, working with them to achieve their educational success, and ultimately reducing attrition rates at UC Davis and across higher education. We believe today's event is just the beginning of our efforts to work with each other across the campus as faculty, staff, students, and administrators to address the multiple issues involved in retention and attrition. Today's topics are not exhaustive. We know that. In fact, we had to postpone several important issues, for instance, the role of health and mental health among Chicano and Latino students in contributing to their attrition. We're going to be discussing these topics in the very near future. We hope that you will join us in our continuing effort to bring about change on the campus specifically. To launch these efforts, we have invited esteemed colleagues from UC Davis, UCLA, and California State University, Sacramento, and American River College, to inform us about the state of Chicana Latino education, specifically in higher ed. Today we have a keynote speaker and a panel of experts who will launch our efforts to study this issue more deeply than has been done in the past and to come up with concrete solutions. We hope to continue these conversations in the winter and spring quarters and in the ensuing years, we hope. And now I would like to take the opportunity to introduce today's keynote speaker, Patricia Gandara. Patricia Gandara is a professor of education and co-director of the Civil Rights Project at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. Her research centers on educational equity and access for low-income and ethnic minority students, language policy, and the education of youth of Mexican origin. Gandara writes and comments frequently on education for youth who speak English as a second language and the education gap among Latinos. She is a former bilingual school psychologist and director of education research for the California Assembly. She also worked as a social scientist at the RAND Corporation. I should also note that she's a former professor from UC Davis, and we welcome her back to the campus. She will speak to us for about 30 to 40 minutes, and then we will open the floor to questions and answer session, and then we will follow up with the panel, our panel of experts this afternoon. Thank you, and welcome, Professor Gandara. Yes, Stu. You're first.
Thank you for being here on what is threatening to be a kind of an awful evening, right, with big storms. I had to say that the invitation to come back to UC Davis was just a wonderful delight to me. And, you know, somebody mentioned, well, maybe you would be too busy. And I said, you know, I don't know what would make me too busy to come back to UC Davis. I have very, very fond feelings about this campus. It's a very important part of my life. So I am going to start with the punchline to this story. I'll start at the end and work backwards. I will try to provide a broad view about what's happening with Latino students in California, but nationally. And what our research suggests are some of the fundamental problems that need to be dealt with right from the very beginning, because as I'm sure all of us understand, the problems of attrition in higher education don't begin in higher education. They begin long before that with the lack of supports and the kinds of things that happen to students along the pathway. So I'm going to take us back a little bit to that to try and focus on what does this pathway to higher education look like, and where, in fact, many of the I'm going to have for you six doable things that can be that we can do, and I think there could ensue, probably not today, but I think there could ensue a really good discussion about how higher education plays a role in each one of these. And maybe it will come up a little bit too in, as the panelists go on. So I'm just showing you a table of numbers, and that doesn't make as much sense as does this. And this to me is kind of the story encapsulated in one graph. What I want you to notice about this, so this is 25-year-olds with a BA or more. I mean, 25 to 29-year-olds with a BA or more. A couple things are really, really notable on here. The enormous gap, the very bottom line is Latinos, by the way. And the enormous gap between Latinos and others, that's, you know, in 2010, that's a pretty impressive thing to see. Look at 1975 and how much smaller that gap was in 1975. So part of the story here is this gap is increasing, and it's increasing phenomenally. And the reason why it's increasing is because you will see an upward, you know, a significant upward slant for every other group, actually even including African Americans who are not doing well and who we also need to pay a lot of attention to. But I think it's impressive how the Latino line from 1975 to 2010 is practically flat. We saw a little blip up in the last couple of years, but for over three decades, this was a kind of 9-11 for over three decades. That, to me, is frightening, because over those three decades, this population has grown enormously, and yet we are not seeing the same kind of increase that we would expect with the increasing numbers. There's basically three explanations for that gap that a lot of people like to assert. The first one is immigration. And with this one, the idea goes that if we just stop immigration at the border, it will solve our educational problems, because after all, it's really these immigrants coming in with low education from their homelands that are causing the problem. Well, the problem with that explanation is that, in fact, a number of studies now have shown that it's the immigrant kids and the children of immigrants who are actually outperforming the second and third generation. So it seems that if we were to do that, we might actually be cutting off some of the flow into higher education. So the reason that trash can is there is I'm going to take that immigration thing. And if I were more clever, I would, you know, actually have this here and I would dump it in. But I'm not that clever. So you can dump it in your own imagination into that trash can. The second explanation that is often given for this is that it's language. If we just teach Latino students English quickly, they'll catch up. And so we've had all of these efforts to ban bilingual instruction, to not give them any primary instruction, and to just do English immersion. Well, it turns out that the studies are now showing us that the kids who were given primary language instruction are actually outperforming the kids who are not. And one of our neighbor institutions here, not in the UC, at Stanford in the last couple of years, has produced a couple of knock-your-socks-off studies, longitudinal, the biggest districts in the state, following the kids from kindergarten through up to high school, and finding that these kids who had primary language instruction in the early years are now outperforming the kids who didn't at the high school level in English proficiency, not to mention academically. We've known for some time that academically the kids are doing better and that they're reading about a third of a standard deviation higher in reading by the time you get to around the fifth grade if you've had primary language instruction. So let me just say that the language explanation into the trash, too. And finally, we have a number of policy folks out there who say, well, look, you know, let's not get too exercised about this because we've had a lot of immigration. And if we just kind of wait it out, Latinos, like all other immigrant groups, will move up the ladder of opportunity. They'll get on. Well, actually, the data are suggesting otherwise, and for a number of important reasons. One, that all those other immigrant groups that came in at times when we had large immigration came into a very different economy, came into a very different context, and it was still possible to make your way without an education. That is no longer possible today. Education is the bottom line to social mobility. If we cannot get these young people educated and well-educated, they cannot compete in a society. I thought I was going to go backwards, but evidently I'm not. In a society where there are those kinds of gaps. So why does it matter so much? Well, this year we hit 53%. I think, Elias, you said 52, but every year we are moving this number up. So this year in California, Latinos are 53% of the students in our K-12. This year, Texas went over the 50% line as well. These are two of the largest states in the nation. These are two very important states to the nation in terms of economy and population. And these are two Latino states now. In 10 states in the country, the Latino population has grown between 200 and 400% in the last decade. So now places like Arkansas and North Carolina and Georgia and Alabama are seeing significant Latino populations that they never dreamed of. Latinos today are 1 in 5 students in the U.S., and by before 2025, they're projected to be 1 in 4 students in the whole country. So this isn't about the future of Latinos. This is about the future of the nation, and more immediately, the future of California and Texas and Nevada and Arizona. We are linked. Whatever happens to Latinos will have an enormous impact on what happens in this nation as a whole. So let me say a couple of things. Tell me what time I have until, so I can figure out. Till 5? Oh. I can do it. Okay. So let me just say a couple things about the context for Latino students. This is really, really important. And, you know, as somebody in education who's been studying these things for longer than I would like to admit, you know, I come back to this. Because we can do education reform until the cows come home. And we can have better curriculum and we can have better everything, and yet when you have a third of your students living in poverty, and particularly given the way we define poverty in this nation, this is the elephant in the living room in many cases. This is really hard to overcome. By the way, I think it's interesting to note that, you know, our definition of poverty remains. There's some of you may have caught that there's the federal government is experimenting with a new way of measuring poverty. And when they did that, they released a few days ago that California had the biggest poverty problem in the nation. We had a higher level of poverty in this state than any other state. But even at that, when we compare ourselves with European countries, other countries that measure poverty, we're laughable. They would not consider what we consider to be below the poverty line. They consider that, well, way, way, way below the poverty line. So today, I mean, think about this for a moment, that 65% of kids who are not in, of Latino kids who are not in poverty, just means that their family is making 50 cents more than about $24,000 a year. The local economy here is a little bit different. I'm living in Los Angeles now, where that's basically the rent for the year. There's nothing left over from that. So anyway, not to beat a dead horse here, but more than a third of our kids are living in very, very dire straits. And many of these, when we say below poverty, is way below poverty level. So another way of looking at it is that 75% and more of Latino kids across the country are eligible for free and reduced lunch. That's the poverty measure for schools. So overwhelmingly, these children are coming from very economically disadvantaged circumstances. I'm just going to skip over this one quickly because this is a figure that changes almost day by day. We almost lost it with Obamacare, and the Congress, you know, cut back on the program for kids who are kind of just above the poverty line. I think they're restoring it. But in any case, very large numbers of our children and their families in the Latino community lack health care, lack access to health care. And even when there is some government health care provided, it doesn't solve the problem for undocumented folks or people who are living in families where somebody is undocumented. So even children who are theoretically covered, oftentimes the families are, if there's somebody undocumented, are afraid to access these services. This figure is now a few years old. We know that this has gone up. It's going up dramatically. At the Civil Rights Project, we are now engaged in re-looking at these figures. But a few years back, 60% of Latinos in the urban West, that's us, attend schools that are virtually all minority schools. They do not see any kids who are from the what used to be the mainstream. I think we're now the mainstream, but they don't see any kids from more advantaged backgrounds. Latinos have the highest residential mobility, largely because of unstable parental employment. And, you know, this is something we talk about poverty, and I know all of you have heard poverty statistics and you hear these conversations. One of the things we don't talk about much is wealth, the opposite. What do you have in the bank, in your pocket, in your purse to actually buy services and goods and to create a better life for yourself and your family? Well, it turns out that among Latinos, this recession has hit harder than any other group because the only wealth that the majority of Latinos have is in their homes, in the value of their homes, which lost the most in the recession because Latinos are in precisely the states, the areas where the recession hit the hardest. So we know now that in the last couple of years, Latinos lost 88% of their wealth. The Latino population today is in a much worse situation than it was just 5 years ago. And then finally, school performance is related to parent education. We don't have any better predictor, really, of how people are going to fare in school than how their parents fared in school, how well they did, what their education level is. That's a really solid predictor. And 40% of Latino kids have parents who did not complete high school, oftentimes did not complete elementary school, but certainly did not complete high school. And so this puts these children at significant disadvantage in terms of navigating the system. Do you see where I'm going with this in terms of what the role of higher education is? I mean, if we begin to look at the bigger picture here, we've got to take these things into account. Oh, boy. This is doing something funny. I'm sorry. We're going to have to wait through it. So let me tell you a couple things about California schools. Oh, I don't know why it's doing that. I don't know why it did that. Okay. This is what the students are up against in the schools, and this is then what higher education is up against as it tries to take over, as the baton is handed over to higher education. California is just about worst in the nation, with one counselor for approximately 900 students. Those of you who have been in high schools recently are not surprised by this, but it's also, I think it's still shocking to think about what can one counselor do with 900 students, particularly if there are 900 needy students whose parents can't provide outside counseling, whose parents have not been through the system and therefore have no idea how it works. There's one psychologist for approximately, it's actually higher than this, but I'm saying approximately 1,400 students. So I know, Mutos, you were talking about later doing stuff on mental health. You know, poverty causes mental health problems. Poverty causes tremendous stress in families that result in needs for support systems. But if a child comes to school from a very low-income background where there's a lot of stress and a lot of need for some kind of psychological support, the chances of actually seeing a psychologist are pretty remote if there's only one for every 1,400 kids. If, because you don't have health care, don't have access to health care, you come to school with some kind of a health problem that is really endangering your schooling, your ability to participate in school. And we know that chronic health problems are a primary reason why kids miss school. They're just gone. They're not there. You can't learn if you're not there. And so for those kids, we have one nurse for every 2,700 students. What's the chance that a kid is going to be able to get any health care access at the school, or anybody who can even begin to understand what kinds of problems they might have? Reading, of course, is the most critical thing that we learn in elementary school. And in fact, after you put aside parental education and socioeconomic status, our best predictors for how you're going to do as you go forward is if you are reading at grade level or above by the third grade. Well, who is there in our system to help kids connect with books, to help kids have that opportunity to understand the power of reading when it's not just a didactic lesson? Well, we have one librarian for every 9,000 students in our schools. That's a travesty. If reading is at the very center of what we're teaching kids, why don't we value having librarians who can help direct that? I don't know about you, but I remember really keenly my experiences in the library when I was a kid. And I remember exactly where in that library all these books were. We have closed down libraries because we have no librarians to open them up. And of course, given the levels of poverty, the levels of distress and disadvantage in the homes, there are many needs for a social worker who can help direct kids and families to services that exist in the community that support them. And in that case, we have one social worker for every 15,000 kids. So, I mean, that's fewer than one per many, many school districts. In other words, many school districts have no social worker whatsoever, so you can forget that one. So, you know, back to this issue about the gaps. Not only are those gaps between, well, and in fact, you can see that it's highly related, you know, these growing gaps from 1975 to 2010 in terms of the completion of college degrees. Well, those people back in 1975 grew up and they had kids. And now their kids are the ones on the prior graph. But these are the parents of Latino children. And what is notable here, of course, is how little growth there has been for Latino kids' parents in terms of completing college, and how that has been growing steadily upward for white kids, so that the disadvantage that we find in parents having the knowledge, the skills, the experience, the ability to help navigate the system for their kids is also growing. And so today, a Latino kid has a much less chance than a white child did in 1979 to have a parent who knew something about this system because they went through it. They're at a further disadvantage today. So not surprisingly, by high school, up to about 50% of Latino males in urban areas have dropped out. Latinos in general are performing several years behind their white peers. Only 36% complete A through G, and I've shown you up there what the comparison figures are, which means that two-thirds of Latino kids are not eligible in this state to go to a four-year college, of any public four-year college, which means that they are automatically going to be directed into the community colleges, where we have problems. Okay, for those of you who work in the community colleges, I want to tell you, too, that I get students in my office every day who say it was the best experience they ever had. It was wonderful. There were caring faculty. There were support systems. But the sad fact is that those are about 12% of the kids who actually enroll hoping to transfer. 88% don't make it. Turns out that most of these kids, if they stay in high school, they do go to college, whatever that means. Unfortunately, too often it means sign up for a couple courses the first semester and drop out. Some people grab onto that statistic and they say, look, things are really not so bad because the majority of Latinos are going to college just like everybody else. The problem is they're not staying there. And I know that that is a topic for discussion today. You'll be talking more specifically about UC Davis. You'll be talking about the very creme de la creme, the very top 12, 10, 8% of these kids in the state who you're having difficulty here retaining. Consider what this retention issue is like in the places that are not creme de la creme. And then we have this problem that Latinos tend to be actually overqualified for the institutions that they attend. So we find that by and large, Latinos who do qualify to come to UC Davis or do qualify for selective four-year universities don't go to them. They go to the local community college or maybe the state university if they're kind of prodded into that, where their chances of graduating are phenomenally less. In the UC system as a whole, I had these figures the other day, but in the UC system as a whole, I believe that the graduation rate, six-year graduation rate, is now 88%. So if you are a kid coming into the UC system, really very, very high chances you're going to finish with a degree. At the CSU system, it was 54%, dramatically less. And if you came into community college, I just told you that only about 12% are actually going to make that transfer. So what happens if we don't solve this problem really soon, like yesterday? Well, we have a very interesting study from a couple years ago. I'm sure that Elias is very familiar with this one, from the Public Policy Institute for California, which pointed out to us that, guess what, guys, we've got a big problem in this state, that by 2025, we're going to have 1 million jobs in this state that require a college degree, but that will go unfilled by Californians. Who are the Californians of 2025? Latino students. That's the kids we have in our system right now who in another few years would be the ones to take that 1 million jobs that will be filled by somebody else, not these kids. Latinos will be competing for the meager jobs at the bottom. There was a study done in 2006 that was a very fascinating study, I thought. It's done by a group called the, Center for Management Systems, Higher Education Management Systems. And they took data from all around the states and did projections for what their economic situation was going to look like given their the participation of their young people in higher ed. What they found for California, which was taking the biggest hit, this is the worst of any state in the nation, that California's per capita income is projected to decline by about 11% between the years 2000 and 2020. So maybe that's 11% is going to go down. Maybe that's not a huge thing. What you need to know is that the economy that we created in this state came as the result of a 30% growth in per capita income between 1980 and 2000. So we're not just talking about a slowing down of the growth. We're talking about a reversal and a downturn, which will have, unless we do something soon, which will have really massively bad effects on this state. Gaps in income, wealth, and education between Latinos and others continue to grow. And what happens when that happens is you begin to get a fraying of the social fabric. We cannot sustain a state and ultimately a nation in which the economy is so polarized, in which so many people are at the bottom of the rung without the ability to get out. We can't keep this up. We must do something. And I know you are all here because you understand that. And people are always asking me, why is it that the rest of the country doesn't understand this? Why is it that the rest of this, even this state, doesn't understand that we are at the precipice? We are looking down into the abyss right now. It's not sometime off in the future. It's now. Okay, so I'm going to suggest to you, based on research that we've done over a number of decades, six things that I think that we can do. Okay, sí podemos. And the six things that I think that we absolutely must do. First is we need to build on these students' assets. We need to move away from the idea that these kids bring nothing with them, only deficits, and I'm going to come back to this. I'm going to come back to each of these. We need to create magnets, that, especially dual immersion schools, that break down these kids' isolation. We need to train and recruit Latino and bilingual teachers, which is just a real big favorite of mine. We need to focus on wraparound services. We need to strengthen outreach, and we'll say a few words about that, and I'm sure you guys will have some things to say about that as well from the higher ed perspective. And we need to do some serious parent outreach. And I think that there is a role for each one of these things here in the higher education system. So let me just first say about building on students' assets. Turns out we have some interesting research coming out of Berkeley in the last few years that shows that while one thing that we have known for a long time is that Latino kids begin kindergarten significantly behind. Poverty does that. It's got nothing to do with language, it's got nothing to do with culture, it's got to do with poverty and opportunity and being isolated. That has something to do also with testing kids in a language they don't understand, but we'll go past that. But it turns out that Latino kids actually have especially strong social skills, as good or better than their white peers. Well, that you probably haven't heard about as much, right? And that you don't hear much about. But that you don't hear much about building on either. Border crossing skills. Latino students who live in bicultural communities and bilingual communities, oftentimes, and especially the ones we see here showing up at Davis, have what some researchers call border crossing skills. They're bicultural. They can move in and out of different environments. The fortunate ones can move in and out of different languages. They can build bridges. They can connect with different parts of the society. This is a tremendous advantage to be able to move in and out of these different environments. And we know that the students who do that best are also our best students. This is something really to build on. Bilingualism. About half of our Latino kids, half of them are not, but about half of our Latino kids are bilingual to some significant degree. At the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, I expect to publish a book next year on this topic, because we're doing a whole series of studies looking at the economic value of bilingualism. White parents know it's important. White parents want their kids to be in these dual immersion programs. They want their kids to be bilingual. But for too long, there has been a silence about this as an absolute asset of Latino kids that so many Latino kids bring to school. We ignore it, and we call it, in fact, I was writing something recently about how it's usually referred to euphemistically, you know, bilingual kids are euphemistically given that label, meaning that they got some kind of disability, right? Ooh, they're bilingual. We need to do something for them. Well, we need to turn that on its head. And the other thing that we have is we have a very large immigrant population, and oftentimes when we say immigrant kids, we're referring to the children of immigrants as well as the people who actually came into the country. And there's a lot of research now on immigrant optimism. Many researchers believe that it's related to the fact that the immigrant kids or the children of immigrants outperform their peers in school because they're still optimistic. The family believes we made this sacrifice so that we could have a better life for you, so that there would be something better here. And the kids act on it. So there's a number of assets that we can build on. Dual immersion schools. There's an exploding demand for these. We have seen this skyrocketing, mostly from middle class, upper middle class, educated, monolingual parents who say, whoa, you know, this would be something that would be great for Janie or Johnny. And interestingly, they come closest to closing achievement gaps of any other program that we have. We could talk at greater length about why that is. At least one of the reasons, though, is because in these kinds of programs, kids, the isolation is broken down because the whole idea is you have mainstream kids who come from homes with lots of assets and bringing them into contact with Spanish-speaking kids who haven't had those same advantages, and there's nothing like a strong peer group that's knowledgeable and knows, you know, in the informal conversations that occur among kids, that's where a lot of learning occurs. So I could go on about this, but there's a lot of research now that shows that these kinds of programs are our best bet for closing gaps. Dual immersion schools also nurture important skills for the labor market. I mean, these kids, whatever background they come from, who manage to come out of these schools, will in fact have an additional set of skills that will be important in getting jobs. Some of this research that we're doing on the value of bilingualism, we're finding very preliminarily that a lot of people are taking advantage of the fact that they have bilinguals in their employ. And they're using them for this purpose while not paying them any extra, which is a little disconcerting. But on the other hand, these kids have a much better shot at the job. So when there's competition for a job, if you have bilingual skills, you're probably going to get the job over the person who doesn't. They also better prepare students for the world in which they're going to live. And as I mentioned, they break down isolation. They bring kids from different backgrounds in contact with each other. And that is a critically important skill that virtually all employers are acknowledging today. You've got to be able to live in a global world. Okay, on to my favorite topic. We need to do serious recruitment and training of Latino and bilingual teachers. For a study this is very exciting to me, this is a study we're going to publish next year. We have found using big national data sets, this is the first time I have seen this, you guys. I've been kind of watching the data on this and the studies that have been done, but this is the first time looking at ELLS data, a big national study of high school students going on to college, that we find that having at least one Latino teacher is predicting for kids, Latino kids going on to college. I think that's a pretty exciting finding. But bilingual teachers, you know, whether they're Latino but bilingual teachers are, of course, are key to building dual immersion schools. If we don't produce bilingual teachers, we cannot have these dual immersion schools that people are clamoring for and that we know are really good at closing gaps. Both Latino teachers and bilingual teachers model an important role in the global society. They represent a much broader array of the people who really live in this world, and they communicate in more than one language, which is what we all need to be doing in the future. Bilingual teachers use more research-based strategies than monolingual teachers. A student of mine at UCLA finished her dissertation last year, a fascinating dissertation. The question that she asked is, so does it make any difference if a child, regardless of whether they're in an English-only setting or not, has a bilingual teacher or not? What difference does the bilingual teacher make? Megan Hopkins found two amazing things, I thought. One was that, and she had a large sample, about 600 in California, Arizona, and Texas, three different policy environments where teachers were under different kinds of constraints, so that she could test this out as well. And what Megan found was that the bilingual teacher in the classroom actually used more research-based strategies in teaching the children. She had that teacher, he or she, had been trained to use more research-based strategies than the regularly trained monolingual teacher. But here's the kicker, I think. The bilingual teachers saw parent contact as their responsibility. And the monolingual teachers saw contact with the parent and school as the responsibility of the parent. So the monolingual teacher sat there and waited for the parent to come to them. And the bilingual teacher said, no, this is my job to go out and meet these parents and talk with them. Well, one of the things that we have known for a long, long time is that connection between the parent and the school is so critical, and it's not happening in so many of the cases of our kids. Well, the bilingual teacher turns out to be pretty key to that. That bilingual teacher, you know, this is ends here because I didn't have any more space. There are a dozen things I could tell you that are super advantages to having one of these teachers. But also, that teacher is able to evaluate the learning of English learners regardless of the program type. Let's say they're only in English, you know, English-only program, you know. The bilingual teacher can assess, is Juanito getting this? Is he, you know, how? Where is he not getting it? Where do I need to adjust my my instruction? The monolingual teacher can't. Wraparound services. Sometimes accused of having deficit thinking because I do a little bit of emphasis on poverty and the ravages that I think poverty has on kids, on their hopes and on their dreams, on their possibilities. I think there's a very prevalent idea that, you know, if we just pull up our socks and we just teach better and we reform our schools better and we have better curriculum and something else, that somehow these kids, of course they can do it. It's only our lack of aspirations for the children that keeps them from excelling and ending up here at UC Davis. I don't believe that. We know that the parents of Latino kids have extremely high aspirations, that they want for their kids what every other parent wants for their kids, but even in higher percentages than other ethnic groups. It's not a lack of aspiration. It's not a lack of desire for this. It's a lack of basic and fundamental kind of infrastructure to support these children who are going to the worst schools that we have to offer. The schools that have the principals and teachers who are in and out of the school within 2 years, that have huge mobility, that have huge problems, and almost no infrastructure in the community to support them either. Poverty undermines those aspirations. Poverty does. Some organizations are trying to address this. An organization out of Washington, D.C., the Communities in Schools, goes into districts. They get themselves invited into districts. They go in and they assess what the needs are, and they help people find providers, find linkages in that community, find people who are willing to help support these kinds of efforts in communities to support families, the social aspects of them. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the Harlan Children's Zone. That is touted all over the place now as being the, you know, this is the answer. These kids are doing fabulously. Well, they're pouring in about $25,000 to $30,000 per kid in order to do that, and they're providing all the things that I and others have listed here need to be provided. The health care, the social service support, the counseling, social work for parents. That's what they're doing. And yes, it does work. It does help when you actually reduce the impact that poverty has on people. You see dramatic changes and improvements. Healthy Start in the state was a good model. Healthy Start we ran for a while as a pilot program. These cannot be pilots. We cannot do this on a pilot basis. The idea is, okay, we'll give you some money and you'll put together these social services and you'll fix the problem, and then in 3 or 4 years somebody is going to ride in on a white horse and they're going to pay for this because the state's no longer going to pay for it. Well, nobody rides in on the white horse. The state pulls out the money and the program is gone. And yet we know that these things work. We have to reinvest in this kind of infrastructure for our kids. We have to. I guess if I have one plea, it's do not be taken in by the idea that the schools can do it alone. That somehow the teachers just haven't cared enough or haven't aspired enough or haven't. Yeah, we have some issues there. We can strengthen that. But it's not going to solve that problem. Right here at Davis and the kinds of outreach programs and the kinds of college access programs that some of you work with, they are an arrow in the quiver. They help. We've done a lot of research on this over time. We know that these kinds of outreach programs are important. They help kids, but they have huge limitations. One of the limitations I'll point out to you is that the data show that about 5% of the kids who could actually profit, who need one of these programs, actually get any kind of consistent contact with them. So overwhelmingly, they're left out of that net. The important thing that they do and that higher education can help make happen is that these programs channel students to regular, the ones that work, channel students into rigorous curriculum. They get them out of the low tracks. They get them out of the dead ends. They get them out of the remedial courses and get them into something that is going to challenge them and where they're going to be surrounded by peers who believe they're going to college. These programs also supplement the counseling that isn't in our schools, especially at the high school and community college. I mean, we have found that, interestingly, one of the problems with the community college transfer, why the kids don't transfer, is because they don't know how to transfer. And nobody ever tells you anything about this in high school. So for the 75% of Latino kids who go on to college in California, the likelihood is nobody ever told them how to transfer. And once they get to community college, they don't know where to go to find somebody who might tell them that, and they lose a lot of time and energy and morale, and they drop out. But we've found that some of the community colleges in this state actually have a significant outreach effort into the high schools to tell them how to use the community college to get to Davis. This is how you do it. So when you come here to American River, we're going to do this and this and this, and then you're going to be at UC Davis. But the high schools are relying on these folks, or the people who we have from UC Davis who go out and say, okay, maybe you're going to have to go to the community college first, and this is what you're going to do to get to UC Davis. But the high schools aren't doing it, and we have to do it. They provide critical information. You know, we did a study so many years back now, maybe 15 years ago, when once again, the University of California was looking at the issue of what's happening with the Latino population in UC, and we found that the single biggest factor in kids not going on to college was simply lack of information. They simply didn't know how to follow the steps to make it happen. And another thing that we found in research over time is that these summer bridge and these first-year experience programs are pretty powerful models. They're costly. That's why everybody doesn't do them. But they work. And I think that's kind of the bottom line story to much of this. You can't change the world on the cheap. If you want to make real difference, if you want really to address this problem, you're going to have to invest in it. And so finally, on parent information, parents still suffer from sticker shock. It remains a big problem. Parents who have no experience with higher education, a number of studies have shown this. They always overestimate how much it costs and underestimate how anyone could possibly pay for it. And so too many kids are dead-ended before they start. And we know that this is a primary reason why they go to colleges that are less selective, because nobody in the family knows how this can possibly be paid for, and they don't have the information. And they see those numbers rising and rising and say, oh, mijo, this is just not possible. They also need information on how to prepare their children for graduation and college, how to monitor what their kids are doing in school, and how to advocate for their kids. This is all stuff that we can do. We know how to do it. Programs like PIQUE, Parent Institute for Quality Education, have been doing it for decades, training parents to be trainers of other parents, which I think is a beautiful model, because parents talk to each other about how this happens. That's it. Those are the six things that I would do, and I would start yesterday, and I would start in the Capitol, and I would, we have a supermajority. We have to be careful with it, okay? We can't just like go on a shopping spree. But, you know, if people really care about the future of this state, I think this is exactly where we need to invest. And I think we need to do it starting tomorrow. Thank you. More comments?
Yeah. I was curious to hear from your perspective as a researcher. You know, you gave us your six suggestions to share with us to consider in our own particular community. But speaking as a community member in Sacramento for the past 10 years, as a community member there trying to as a parent, trying to see how we can actually change things, not just for my children. They have relative advantage. I recognize that. I'm aware of that and carry that responsibility. But carrying that responsibility, also looking at the parents, other Latino parents that have been here for now two generations, and for the recently arrived, and for all the things that you mentioned, and where have you seen the models nationally where you find hope in terms of where you see things working? I'm just curious to hear what
you know, I spend so much time in the Civil Rights Project working on hopeless causes. we just came off of 2 years in Arizona where we're batting our heads against the wall on what's going on there, and then the loss of affirmative action in the Supreme Court. And but, yeah, I have to say that I do the research, but I do have colleagues who are doing some fairly extraordinary things in the Los Angeles area now. And I haven't been up to date with exactly what is happening here, but you know, UCLA has this labor center that they're always trying to defund because they consider them wild radicals. They're wild radicals because what they're trying to do is organize low-income people to not only unionize and advocate for better working conditions, better pay, and that, but also to organize around the schools. And a lot of these union members and groups in the Los Angeles area are really taking it to the schools. They are training their parents about what it is they need to expect and how to notice when it's not there and then what to do about it. So I think that there are avenues like that, and I think that oftentimes unions and organizations that are organizing these low-income and immigrant folks are good avenues to begin to push at the school systems as well. Thank you for a really good question, by the way. That's a really good question.
Microphone up here, so the question?
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Proposition 2, I believe, in Michigan, was recently overturned
by
the Fourth Circuit Court.
Right.
But this Ninth Circuit Court upheld constitutionality of Prop 209. Now we have the Fisher University of Texas case. Say that University of Texas prevails. What do you think that means to California and Prop 209? And does that matter?
Well, I think it would only matter in terms of California is turning. I mean, you know, this was a very exciting election. I think prior to this year, I would have said, you know, it's a dead issue here because even if Texas prevails in the Fisher case, which is the latest iteration, you guys, those of you who are not familiar with trying to ban affirmative action entirely, even if Texas were to prevail, I mean, we have been without affirmative action since 1996 in this state, and that would not change as a result of a Supreme Court decision. That would be a miraculous one, by the way, but because basically the decision would simply say that you can use it, and they'll probably say under what very, very, very extraordinarily extreme circumstances. But so it doesn't give us any more freedom here in the state. However, with a very different electorate in this state now, and with a very different legislature, I think, yeah. You know, most lawyers talk about not absolutely overturning, but creating enough inroads in it that it makes it porous, and it allows us a whole lot more freedom to move in there. And I would hope that that would begin immediately here in California, that people would start looking at ways to... And there is some language out there that would actually overturn it. You're right. And maybe the time is right for that. You know, maybe we don't have to go slowly, like, you know, dismantling it. Maybe it's possible because the electorate in California is a totally different electorate than it was in 1996. Yeah, let's hope, huh? Let's hope. Of course.
About the 30% transfer rate, you know, completion for Latinos is even
a great.
So how do you see
this new legislature, this new opportunities, hopefully, for us to gain other things? Can we, you know, fund the resources that are really needed to make this College Success Task Force really viable?
So, if you quote me outside this room, I'm going to deny it. But I saw some earlier drafts of the Student Success Initiative, which were stronger than what they came out with, which would have held the institution's feet more to the fire, which would have, I think, attacked the issues more head on. I was really kind of disappointed with this as sort of, it's not that there's anything bad in there. I mean, you know, they'll make some incremental differences on the margin, but there's nothing exciting in there that I can find. So this is just my own opinion. Actually, in the Civil Rights Project, we're getting ready to launch something around this issue, probably with the Ford Foundation, around really rethinking the whole model for community colleges and students of color. And our thinking has been more along the lines that the community colleges need to be absolutely integrated with four-year colleges. And maybe we need to even create four-year community colleges like they've done in Miami-Dade, where you can go to community college and you can get a four-year degree. We have to do something, I think, dramatically different enough And that's hard to do. The student success thing was committee meeting after committee meeting of people who were on all ends of the spectrum. And, you know, and if you talk to folks on the inside, which you may well be, you know, who were a part of that, you know, it was a question of negotiating, something that everybody could live with. But I think we need something that people makes people real uncomfortable.
Thanks. So I don't think this is a quick question, though, so you might just pass it on. But so your presentation has been wonderful. There's lots of really great recommendations and information in there. But your presentation talks about the Latino population as a whole in education, and there's very significant differences within that population. One of the major ones is by gender. Do you have maybe one or two things we can do to close the gender gap and to address the real deficits for by gender?
Yeah. I think the first thing I would say is for all of you who are graduate students or about to be graduate students and are interested in this, there are wonderful dissertations to be written on this because we really don't know that much. At least we don't know that much in a published form. There are probably people who are holding some wonderful ideas in their heads, but we don't have them out there in the world. One of the things that I found astounding, and this is back in 2000 when we were surveying these outreach programs and college access programs across the country, went to all 50 states to find out what was going on. Figure, we published this in 2000, data that are collected in 1998. This is a while back. Even at that point, these programs that were set up to get kids into college, who were coming from African-American, Latino, or Native American backgrounds. Even at that point, two-thirds of all of the participants in those programs were females. And it got to the point where I could just call somebody up and say, oh, well, tell me about your program. And then the first question or the second or the third question I would ask would be, and you have about two-thirds females, right? I said, well, how'd you know that? I didn't tell you that. I said, because every program in the country does. So this is a problem of long standing, and of course we're seeing it now in the graduation rates, and the kinds of responses that I hear out there, I don't think are really hitting on the problem, like, oh, the schools are too feminized. Well, the schools have always been feminized. You know, that's not anything new. I think it's a real fundamental change in our society. And I think that one of those changes is we took the lid off of women, and we were very worried, and rightfully so, about women's opportunities. And when we took the lid off, the women really moved massively ahead, leaving the guys behind. Latino males are not doing that much worse today than they were two decades ago. They're just doing a lot worse in comparison to the women. It's the women who have moved forward. Now we need to work on how we get the guys to join them. Thank you very, very much.
I'd like to welcome up here the panelists, and next we'll have Elias Lopez, University Registrar here from UC Davis. So I'd like to welcome everybody. Okay. I'll turn it over to Gloria Rodriguez, my colleague here at UC Davis.
Well, good afternoon, buenas tardes. This is a special honor for me, and I'll tell you why. You know, sometimes I think of great people in the world, right? You know, and somebody that comes to mind is Cesar Chavez, because they were able to make an impact statewide, nationwide, but at the same time, when you went and met that person, they also made an impact with the individual. They cared for the individual. So I have a list of people that I kind of have a special list of people that are special on that list. And one of them is Patricia Gandra. And because she, through her research, makes an impact nationwide and statewide, But when I was an undergraduate, she was the one that encouraged me to go and get a doctorate. When you look at my dissertation, one of her signatures is Patricia Gandara. So for me, Patricia, you know, you'll always be in my heart, and I want to thank you, and I think you made a big difference in changing the trajectory in my life. Because I was one of those statistics where my mom didn't graduate from high school, my grandfather, who was the head of the household, we were living in a household of 18 in San Francisco, didn't even know how to read or write in Spanish. And but coming into UC Davis, Patricia noticed me as an undergraduate, told me to take a lot of courses in statistics, guided me through. And so I feel very fortunate to be in the same panel with her. And so, un abrazo. Yeah. And I also feel fortunate to be, or also, you know, with my esteemed colleagues here, because I think that I have a great esteem for them and for the work that they do. And so I'm very fortunate also as well. And I'd like to thank Miros and Mayra and Alma and all the students and everybody who was involved in doing this. Let me talk a little bit just about, I brought three slides. And I brought three slides because I think, you know, I'm a simple-minded person. And I think in terms of what are the things that we can keep track over time, little by little, in simple data form. And that's the way I think. But I bring this because, you know, a few of us, and Timo was just whispering in my ear and says, hey, are you going to mention the 30-mile radius? And so for us, we've always had this concept. There's a few of us, a lot of us, I think, and then there's some of us in the audience that have also worked with this, people like Joaquin and Griselda and all of us that have been part of these meetings. And it's a concept of we have this big societal problem, all right, and what is it, what part can we control? What is the part that we control? So a few years back, we came up with this concept of a 30-mile radius, right? And the 30-mile radius goes something like this. You know, you have a university like UC Davis. Take any university, but let's take UC Davis. And they think of themselves as national and international. But what is the responsibility for the backyard? Well, that's the 30-mile radius. Because the responsibility for the backyard is not just UC Davis, but it's also Sacramento State University. It's also, you know, Sac City, it's American River, and all of us need to be working together. So the first slide that I'm going to show you has to deal with that. Because here is what we have. And this is 2011 data for this, 2011 data for the state. And as Patricia said, you know, for the K through 12, it's even larger now. But for the state, in 2011, according to the American Community Survey, there's a little over 14 million Latinos, 38% of the nation. You go to the K through 12, right, over 3 million Latinos, 52%. You know, the high school graduating class is 45%. The percent in the community colleges is 36%. At CSU is 29%. And then we get to Davis, 17%. At the undergraduate level, 9% at the graduate level, 9% in our professional schools. So for us, we have all of these institutions represented, right? We have Sacramento State University, we have UC Davis, we have Sacramento City College, American River College, Woodland, so that we have a whole host of community colleges, and then we have programs like the Student Recruitment and Retention Center, and we have the Chicano Studies program that does all these seminars and theme programs. We have, you know, a whole host of retention programs also at UC Davis that are following students that Timo may talk about in terms of following students into their community college to make sure that they come here. So the question always in my mind is, how do we get to a point where we're all working together in the same coordinated approach with some basic statistics that we say, yeah, we want to change that 17%, like Walter Robinson, Director of Admissions, would say, you know, to 25%, or Timo says that also a lot. But we want to be able to move those statistics, and what is the plan that we're going to put? Do we put a strategic plan together? What do we do? Now, let me show you the other piece. the other piece, and I think that this is something that could be done for Sacramento State University or at a community college, but what is it that, okay, we get a Latino student here, that's good, right? But, you know, are we having them graduate? You know, the best statistic of performance is graduation rate, right? You could look at 1 year retention, you could look at 2 year retention, you could look at their GPA while they're here, but are they graduating? And so in Davis, you know, for freshmen, 34% of the freshmen are graduating on time. That means they're graduating in 4 years. For transfer students, it's 44% are graduating in 2 years. They're graduating on time. The ones that took one extra year, you see that it's 32% for both, and then took 2 years longer, then it's 5%. So the overall graduation rate for freshman Latino is 71%, you know, and that'd be the 6 year graduation. And the overall graduation rate for transfer students is 81%. The opposite of that would be the dropout rate. So we have 29% of the Latino freshmen drop out, right? They move, they leave for some reason, they get dismissed for a variety of reasons, for financial reasons, and 19% for transfer students. So the question also that I come back to is, you know, could we have, you know, data that we can track if we develop this concept of a 30-mile radius, that we can say, what is it that we want? What is it that we need to do? Do we need to bring that 34% to a 40% for freshmen incoming? And what is it that we need to do collectively? Okay, and that's not just an issue of UC Davis, but what is it that we need to do if they're trying, you know, if they're coming directly from high school and the transfer case is what they're doing with the community college? What is it that with the transitions that we need to do? And then that brings me to my last slide. I can't tell you how sad I get sometimes because I go to a Latino who's graduating, and I said, "Hey, you know, how you doing? What's your plans? What's your major? Oh, and what do you want to do?" And then it's usually the same answer. They say, "I want to go to law school. I want to go to medical school. I want to go to graduate school." And so then I let them talk for a little bit, and then once I think they feel comfortable with me, I asked them for their cumulative GPA. Well, it's very rare that I get a GPA at this level. It's very rare. Most of the time it's 3.1, 3.2, 2.9, and then I kind of like look and say, oh my, you know. So then, and I have a really hard time with that because then I don't know how to help them beyond that. What do you say? You know, when, you know, for the UC Davis School of Medicine, the average admitted GPA was 3.6. For the UC Davis Law School, 3.6, right? And then if you look at dentistry school, somebody wants to go into a related field, well, it's 3.5. So I think that goes to the other goal, because it's not enough that we get them here, you know, and then that we have a coordinated approach. It's also, we need to make sure that they're graduating on time and that we reduce the dropout rate. But then when they're here, what are the programs that we are going to put in place to make sure that, you know, whether they're transfer students, whether they're incoming freshmen, that we are going to put in place. And then with that, it's my job was kind of to set the tone for the panelists. And let me pass them over to them.
Teacher voice. All right. All right, I guess my teacher voice is not going to work. Okay. So I'm Gloria Rodriguez. I'm an associate professor in the School of Education, and I really appreciated how Elias begins, because I guess as I was sitting there next to my, you know, very good friend and colleague, Julie Figueroa, who's part of our panel, listening to Dr. Gandara, You know, it's hard not to really focus in on what you were describing as the asset of social skills that we build in our communities. And so it's really powerful to know that you have lots of different connections with folks. Dr. Gandhar actually helped recruit me to apply to the job here at UC Davis. So, you know, it makes a big difference. And when I see folks kind of coming here and we're coming together out of a serious concern that we all share. And as a faculty member, you know, I want to give sort of special appreciations for the staff who work on our campus, some of whom are represented on the panel and some of whom have been behind the scenes putting this together. Because I think that there is this very artificial, at least for Latino students, a very artificial divide between academic affairs and student affairs that is not unique to Davis. It's pretty common in higher ed to have that division. But what that means is that those of us who are faculty members are often a little clueless about what it is that it takes in order for the students that we get the privilege to teach every quarter, what it takes for them to even be in their seats, what it takes for them to even know what they might need to do as far as preparations for their next steps, whether it's work or grad school or whatever other aspirations they may have. So we might be very myopic, some of us, as faculty, and zero in on academics. And certainly the data that are provided kind of get our juices flowing because we're all excited about data. But those data are really represented by human beings that we come to really care about very deeply as teachers, as mentors, and as part of a broader community. And so it's a special privilege for me to be able to moderate this panel. I'm going to do my best because everyone brings lots of expertise. I think it'll inspire lots of questions, and we're encouraging that, but we wanted to make sure that we did maximize the opportunity for you all to hear the responses in some ways to the picture that we've gotten, both the national scene and the statewide scene that Dr. Gandhar provided for us, as well as the more local scene that that Elias just shared with us. But I wanted to first introduce everyone, and then what I did was I put together two very simple prompts that are in front of each of our panelists just to kind of get things going. Okay, so on our panel today we have Timoteo Rico, or Timo. Many of you know him as Timo, who is, I'm not sure if we have the correct title here on this sheet, because the title seemed to shift daily. but certainly a very pivotal role as the director of recruitment, associate director of recruitment, and also as a result of that, very much involved in undergraduate admissions here at UC Davis. And then next to him is Rick Ramirez, who is part of the counselor faculty at American River College and has numerous connections and relationships to several students and faculty and staff here at our campus. And then we have Dr. Julie Figueroa, who is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Sacramento State. And then we also have a very important perspective represented by Montserrat Garcia, who is an undergraduate student here at UC Davis and also one of our McNair scholars. So to start out the panel, I'm just going to grab my little script. So what I'd like to do is to have each of our panelists respond to a couple of very simple prompts. And so however you each choose to do this and how you want to allocate your time, I'll just keep track of our overall time. But the first one is, given now the data that have been presented and the issues that were so compellingly shared with us by Dr. Gandhar in her opening remarks, and then now we see the scene here, the data picture for UC Davis, what can your research or practice in education tell us about how best to understand the issues of student recruitment or retention at our campus? And also, what are some useful support strategies that we can keep in mind that are informed by your research or practice? Okay, so however you all want to address those, each of you probably has your own entry point. So I'll go ahead and start with you, Timo, if you'd like
okay.
to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for attending today's event. What I do want to emphasize is that my background is in the recruitment, and although recruitment is a general term that's thrown out in the community, there's a variety of topology that actually exists in how students are prepared and towards higher education. Typically, there is the outreach component that are very effective in ensuring that low-income and first-generation students have access to higher education. And as Patricia Gandara mentioned earlier, having access to the social capital and the information for individuals to make the decisions towards social capital is a critical piece that is limited. Now, in the research that I've concentrated on has been really primarily looking at K-12 outreach programs and the type of effectiveness towards student efficacy. In other words, what strategies that are implemented and provided to students can we assure are providing a positive impact towards student success? In many of these instances, when the student has been successful against all the challenges that they've experienced, everybody comes out to claim that it was a benefit from that student. And we do know from a few recent in-state research projects that we've done, specifically with the early academic outreach program here at the Davis campus, that there are specific modules of services that produces a student's impact towards enrolling in a four-year institution. For example, at the Davis campus, they have a standard that they developed called College Knowledge, clear-cut modules that are delivered on a one-hour process to a cohort of students as early as eighth grade, and for every 1 hour that the students receive services, it increases their likelihood to enroll into a four-year institution by 7%. Similarly, they have another standard known as academic advising, in which they provide those services to a student as early as eighth grade on a one-to-one basis for a minimum of 15 minutes. It increases the student's likelihood to complete the A3G requirements and to enroll to a four-year institution. This is very in alignment with the research that Professor Gandara has mentioned about ensuring that students have access towards selectivity of high competitive schools. And then recent research in reviewing these cohort of students that have gone through the early academic outreach program has begun to show fruitful evidence that specific strategies within those two standards that they've implemented is impacting the persistence and the retention of those students. So the advice that I would provide with individuals, especially students and prospective outreach programs who are beginning to develop strategies, is to begin to research with current models that are in place that are beginning to look at the efficacy. Primarily, many of the efforts have concentrated at looking at what is the least costly, and we're learning that you have to invest to produce, and then what is the most effective. Well, you need to produce resources and insert resources to such programs in order for them to be effective. The most immediate aspect is the recruitment part, which is ensuring that students immediately have the information to have access to the information. One of the elements that we're interested in exploring at the campus is that knowing that 50% of the campus is 50% of the prospective students are bilingual students, ensuring that the information is not only readily available in the Spanish language for the student, but for the parents. We do know that the family is a core decision maker towards the student's access in the application process. With that, I invite you to contact me via email or phone call so I could direct you to these resources of research that have already been shown fruitful to ensure that students have access to the University of California. And I want to highlight the Early Academic Outreach Program, Michelle Dyke, the director, because they do have very strong modules for students who are interested, even as undergraduates, to implement to support some of these efforts and increase our enrollment at the Davis campus.
Hi. You can hear me with this microphone. I have a teacher's voice. I'm used to speaking loud. My name is Rukhan Midas. I'm actually the Transfer Center Director and Counselor Faculty at American River College. I just completed a dissertation about 2 years ago, and one of the topics that I focused primarily was looking at the experiences of Latino students at community colleges. So what I did is I examined, and I actually did a qualitative study on the experiences of students. And I know we talked about, you know, some data. Some of the data that I found, and of course CPEC is out of shop now, so with the limited data that we looked at, generally speaking, when we're looking at CSU and UC campuses, the public institutions in California, roughly about 1.4% of all Latinos that enrolled at a community college statewide actually do transfer to CSU. And in looking at other data, roughly about 0.33% of all Latinos enrolled at California community colleges statewide actually transfer to UC. And I always say they're not all going to Berkeley. But when I looked at this data, and I examined the, many of you have probably seen the Chicano Latino educational pipeline, where we see that, you know, of 100 kindergarten students would eventually, you would find out of that, 17 would actually be enrolled at a community college, with one actually transferring to any of the public four-year institutions in California. So that was kind of my background. And being a practitioner, being at a community college for 12 years, what's unique about our system, too, is that counselors are actually faculty, so we have a lot of influence and shared governance and whatnot. But this kind of scenario and this kind of prompt me to really look at this, because in my previous background has been working at UC campuses. I've been at Santa Barbara, Berkeley, and at Santa Cruz, working primarily with EOP students and doing retention type of work. So this kind of was more close to home with me. So one of the things that I looked at, and what's really nice to hear what Dr. Gandara spoke today, is many of the tenets that she brought up really validated some of the qualitative studies that I looked at. Some of the things that really came to mind that popped up as I was diligently writing notes and scribbling on this pad and trying to recollect my thoughts on this whole process was that, you know, one thing that stuck in mind is just the whole idea of outreach. With limited funds and resources, the information provided to students in high schools is really critical. And one of the things that we try to do as counselors is to really go out to the high schools, and it's usually on our own time, because we have informal connections with local high schools, is to really go out and disseminate the information to students. Because of limitations in college counseling at K-12 high schools, I mean, our presence at like college fairs and even informal visits are critical. At American River, in fact, we actually cover a pretty huge service area. Me personally, I cover the Yolo County area. So I actually go out to Woodland, even out to Dixon and Winters High Schools, and give out community college information to students. So along with that is the information about transferring. I, too, was a recruiter for UC and did outreach to students about the whole idea of getting a baccalaureate degree. So that information is critical. In my interviews with students, the knowledge, the information needed, or just the whole process of transferring, I mean, was really important. And I was surprised, well, I should say not surprised. Many students shared with me that they had no idea how they could transfer. Even their interactions with certain counselors, the information provided them was not there. They felt confused. And I would say countless times in my interviews with students, they also shared kind of a lack of interest in their career goals, in their major. It was more about take this, take that, and you're out. Okay, so that was really important to know. And in my practice, and what I do as a practitioner, I think it's really critical, especially working with Brasa students, is really get to know who they are. It's kind of simple. Get to know they are, identify what their goals are, and also dispel a lot of mythologies about what UC is all about, because the transfer process and the GPAs and whatnot are certainly a lot different than getting out of high school. I teach a course as well at American River, so I share a lot of my findings with my students, because I actually teach a transfer course. Some of my former students are even in here. So that was really pivotal. Another thing, too, is proximity is really an issue as well. For many Latino students, I think proximity to family and I think proximity to home is also a big factor. Again, family roles, and oftentimes that's associated, you know, wanting to stay home is associated with information about affordability, about financial aid. So one of the things that I do is, you know, I've done some research on, you know, financial aid, understanding what that is, comparing, you know, EFC, estimated family contribution, comparing that to cost of education, kind of educating students about the process of financial aid. It's what I call financial literacy, if you will. So that's really important for many of community college students at where I'm at. And that's a big thing because, again, the first thing that comes to mind, UC, private institutions, the first thing that comes up is cost. I can't afford it. That's it. So, again, knowledge, going back to knowledge, information, being well-informed, That's powerful. It's also motivating. So that's another big thing. Relationships and support. We have a number of programs at our campus and actually system-wide throughout the community college system that provides support for Latino students. One notably is the Puente program. But I would say, I mean, we have almost 5,000 Latino students at American River College, and Puente only serves a small group, about 35 students. So my idea is that, you know, I pulled out what was valuable in Puente. What are the things that were valuable in Puente? One of them was the relationships established with an instructional faculty member, a counselor faculty member, and also the ability to go out and do volunteerism and community type of service, and also the mentoring part. My idea is that why can't we institutionalize a model like that? Because my idea is that what works for Latino students should be able to work for everybody. And, you know, and that's kind of my idea behind that. Another thing, too, is I'm going to go back to Dr. Gandara's presentation. My study was really focused on looking at dispelling the idea of cultural deficit, looking at the whole concept of community cultural wealth, looking at the capital that Latinos bring. And I really feel that we as practitioners, we as policymakers and academics really should, we really need to just do a shift in looking at what our students bring to the table, especially at the community college. And again, I'd say when we look at faculty, instructional faculty, there's certainly a need to have representation of raza among the ranks of faculty at community colleges. I'm in the Academic Senate at American River College. I'm the only Latino in Senate, and that's not surprising. But when we look at the pipeline, and I look at the big picture, community college faculty require that you have to have at least a master's degree. One of the things that we talk about with our students is not just getting the bachelor's degree. It's looking beyond, you know, and I'm thinking about what Elias mentioned earlier about graduation. We need to really start encouraging and motivating our students to move beyond the baccalaureate, because that's pretty much where leadership is looking at toward in the future. If we're going to have representation, we need to have representation at the postgraduate level. What else? So, again, the information is critical. Counselors, I believe, we're pretty much the gatekeepers of opportunity. We're the ones that have information. Counselors have information on how to navigate through the numerous classes that are required to transfer, and I feel very confident as a transfer center director to be able to like share that information, share that wealth, not just to my colleagues, but to students to share that information. So it's just a process of having not only knowledgeable counselors of the consistent and constant updating of information, but also the ability to be culturally competent, and also the ability to kind of take a step back and really work with students and recognize that students bring something to the table. I'll use another example. I caught myself years ago doing this. You know, it's like you meet a student and you're like, okay, well, where do you want to go? Well, I want to go I want to transfer to a campus local. And I often caught myself doing this in the past. It's like, well, why don't you get out? Why don't you move out? And then I realized, I'm like, you know what? That familial capital, that connection with family is oftentimes critical. That's the foundation. And as a counselor, I need to recognize that. So that's one thing in practice that I try to be mindful of, is to not necessarily instill a value or a that, you know, is connected to a goal that may not be reflective, that may not be aligned with where the students are at. So one more thing before I run out of time. Am I out of time? yeah, okay. Just zap me. The issue of Latino men came to mind. When I was at Santa Cruz as an EOP counselor, we had a men's group there called Los Compas, and it was great. Many of those students at that time are now have gotten their PhDs. That's definitely something that really needs to be happening in terms of really trying to work with young men. And I think with the few Latinos that are out there that are in faculty positions or leadership positions, I think it's really important that we acknowledge that and really try to mentor young men. Overall, we really need to mentor our students. And I think, again, at where we're at community colleges, it's critical that we really start talking to them about not just bachelor's degree, but beyond early on. So with that, I wanted to just...
Which is a good segue to Dr. Figueroa's work, actually.
Sorry. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. How are you today? Buenas noches. One of the things I kind of want to take you back to is when I think about my work is actually focused on academic success, right? So I was always curious. I actually graduated from UC Davis. I double majored in sociology and Chicano studies while I was here. And it was a good fit for me. And but I was curious what happened to other people in that journey. Does that make sense? And I grew up in Eastside San Jose, and so as I progressed through my education and found myself in Berkeley, that was both shocking, right? In the state of California, no one in my program was Latino, right? Now, I started focusing on success, not just because I thought it was easy, right? So I know, Fonsi, say you talk about academic invulnerability, that vulnerability, right? But I also want to point to the idea that curiosity about understanding who gets to graduate school took me back to studying kindergartens for a very long time. Because that's where it starts, right? That's where we start cultivating the student identity. And beyond that, one of the things that I learned about when I think about academic success, because my research is actually on Latino men in higher ed, and particularly undergrads, is that when we talk about the notion of a transfer student or transitioning from one context to the other, I realized very quickly as a faculty member that every year is a transfer year. Every year is a transition year for students. Does that make sense? And so that clued me in right away. So every year, it's like, okay, so this year, here's what you need to be thinking about. And next semester, you're going to come back to me, right? And part of it is, one of the things that we do very well is we talk about this pipeline, and I know, Patricia, you talk about this as well as other higher ed folks. We talk about this pipeline, and one of the things that I think is very interesting is that students begin to develop a sense of comfort in thinking that whatever they've learned to do well in terms of skill, it's decontextualized, it's universally transferred to higher ed. So in other words, the academic skills that they have are transferred to higher ed, but there's also a shift in context that mediates the possibility of that happening. So sometimes you'll find these really high achievers on academic probation by the end of the first year. So it's not just, so we've always talked academics, which is good, right? We need that. And we also need to be able to say that, academic success is also a socially mediated experience, right? Study groups, going to your faculty member, getting a mentor, being a part of a research team, right? I myself was part of Murals. I was a Healthy Start kid. I started EOP. I went to Summer Bridge, right? I think Elias shepherded my family from the parking lot into the dorms because we were huddled by the car and my parents were like, we're going to leave you. And I said, I know. And so it takes everybody. Right? And that's the part that we don't translate well sometimes for students. They still see it as an individuated journey, an individual journey. You work hard, and sometimes the message by default is a feeling of isolation, right? And one of the things I've learned, right, from working with Miguel Molina, who's here, and even the models that I learned as an undergrad, right? So going to Elias, going to Griselda, Joaquin, I think I was in his office all the time. And definitely finding a place in Chicano studies helped me feel like I had different people I could go to. And people knew me, right? The visibility and invisibility that can happen on a large campus, even at Sacramento State, can be reduced when you start making the point of saying, I know who you are. I want you to come to class. So does that make sense? So I'll see people tabling. I'm like, we got class in 10 minutes. You want to walk over with me? Right? And part of it almost takes that, right? The other part that I find to be really interesting is somebody who thinks about, because every time I teach is a research moment for me. It's a data gathering for me. Does that make sense? So, you know, I teach the Chicano Mexican American Experience, which is focused on education, right? And I teach this other course called La Mujer. And what I find to be interesting is the students have a hard time participating. Does that make sense? So immediately in their minds, and I've actually tried to unpack that, they often tell me, oh, no, I'm motivated. I'm like, oh, I'm not. Motivation is not the question. What I'm realizing is we've done a really good job in having you be active listeners. All right. So by the time you get to higher ed, some of the students are like, oh, no, right? By the time you get into higher education, here's what the shocking thing that happens. So what did you think about that reading? Right? And everybody's like, I hope they're looking past me and not at me. Does that make sense? So when we think about what we're doing in the classroom specifically, I think about how can we begin to bring in such items as personal leadership? Right? How do we end poverty? How do we make educational equity? Right? How do we end or address some of these issues? It begins with your own personal leadership. Did you finish the readings? Right? Did you edit your paper more than once and know that with confidence you're not submitting a draft but a really revised, polished, right? Does that make sense? But sometimes our students don't know that. Decontextualized notions of academic success. Right? The other part, what I think is interesting, particularly when I think about Latino men, the College Board actually started an initiative on men of color. So they have a whole initiative, and they started dialogue days. And I sat there with some colleagues on the portion that had to do with Latino males. And one of the things that I find to be really interesting is, you know, the notion of this, the simplest notion of getting help. There's lots of experiences that come up for Latino men in terms of getting help. What does that look like? How do they perceive that process for themselves? And what's interesting is somehow they've linked getting help with somehow there's this notion that they're fighting back homophobic tendencies. Admitting that they need help, they're like, oh, I can't admit that to a guy. They're going to think that's gay. Right? Which I thought was interesting. So the notion of seeking social support from other people, particularly other men, is a very interesting notion. Does that make sense? The other part that I think is also interesting is how they've also translated for themselves or how they've made sense of what it means to be academically successful, right? So we have this strong practice, and it's, you know, it's not a mystery, right? Where our practice in schooling is really based on a meritocracy where you work as an individual, which really aligns really well with notions of masculinity. Does that make sense? So sort of unpacking that experience becomes very important. Oh, and there is a book coming on that, right? Right, we're just finishing it up. But I think those are the important things. The other part I would say, thank you, Monserrat, for being patient. I just have one more point to make. And the other point that I want to make is, you know, one of the things that I learned very well from Chicano Studies is that you can educate and still leave people with a sense of humanity. And so while I teach, I also have to purposely build in days or just segments. I'm not talking about 15 minutes. Sometimes I'm talking about 5 where I'm saying, how are y'all doing? And they're so astonished. They're like, you care? I'm like, here's one thing I know. We can't change this representation of bilingual teachers, of the under representation of faculty, or how students are doing if we don't get personally invested in our students. So Eduardo, Yesenia, people who I know who are in this room, I tell them, look, I know someday I'm going to retire, so you got to take this on too, right? So you get invested early, and you lead and treat them like it's going to happen, and you don't back down. Does that make sense? Because that's what they need to know. Because sometimes their hopes and dreams are only, it's not that they're not big. It's just that they don't know it could be bigger, right? And sometimes what I tell students is, sometimes you don't know what you don't know because you don't know that you don't know it, right? Our job, because we've been through it, right, Patricia, right, is we know that journey, right? And so we can demystify certain things for our students. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I hope everybody's been enjoying the panelists. So my name is Montserrat Garcia, and I am a fifth year psychology and Chicano studies double major, and I'm originally from Santa Ana, California, which is in Southern California. And as a former resident advisor for the Chicana Latino Latina House, or formerly also known as Casa Cuauhtémoc, and as a former EOP advisor, which is an education opportunity program peer advising counselor, I learned a lot about students, and I learned that it's important for them to be integrated to the campus, specifically Chicano Latino students, but not only them, their families as well. I learned that during the 1 month residential program that they came to UC Davis, the STEP program, the Special Transition Enrichment Program. Did I get it right, Joaquin? Okay. There's so many acronyms at Davis that I mess them up sometimes. I learned that parents were really interested and wanted to know a lot of things during the orientation, and they wanted to learn more. And we had a Spanish session for them, and they just were very invested, and they said that they didn't know that Davis could offer like an orientation program for them. So that motivated me to have them talk to each other and exchange numbers. And it was interesting because they all had the same worries that their kids were leaving home, that they didn't know when they were going to see them. So I feel that not only should the students be integrated to UC Davis, but also the families. They seem to care a lot, and I feel like there's some notion out there that parents don't care, parents of Latino students don't care, and for me, this didn't shock me because, I mean, my parents definitely care, and it's just that they didn't know who to go for this information. So that was one point that I wanted to make. Another one is that we keep on saying, how do we look beyond like going into graduate school and stuff like that. And as a current pre-professional and pre-graduate student receptionist, I learned that there's three people here on campus that take, that can see students and advise them for pre-med, pre-health, and pre-law, and pre-graduate. So that, and three of those faculty or professional staff throughout the week, only one is there full-time. So technically, they're is one person on board for the whole week. So, and there's way more of us students, and this is for the entire UC Davis body. So it really shocks me to see how much resources do we actually have for students to go beyond just an undergraduate degree. So for me, that's I'm pretty much asking, hopefully after this we can have more professional staff that can really help students to go into med school, law school, and graduate school if that's what they're interested in, because if only one person's there the whole time for the whole week, so where do the rest of us go? I mean, I am a McNair Scholar, so I have my McNair Scholar Director that I can go to, which is sitting right there, and I could go to Adela because we have formed those relationships, and formally I could go to Joaquin as my EOP advisor. So, but other students that are not as privileged to be in those part of those programs, like what happens to them? So that's pretty much it. Thank you.
You'll see from the agenda that we're going to actually going to need some help from someone, Mayra, okay, to distribute this. Oh, thank you, Miros. Here you go. On the next part of the agenda, I do want to clarify that we, you know, this was one, I wanted to thank all of the panelists because I feel like you really also enriched the picture even further. And so I want you to, the audience participants, I'd like you to definitely note your questions because we will get to them very, very quickly. But in the interim, as an interim step, what I wanted to invite people to do, this was what you're getting here in your yellow sheet, is directed at my faculty colleagues, but I wanted to open it up on the request and suggestion of some of the students who served on the planning committee, that this is not a pledge that would be unique or solely for faculty to consider, but really anyone in the room. So some examples that came up had to do with peer support for how do we really think about our individual roles and responsibilities in supporting the success of Latino students at our campus, and at this point really focusing on undergraduate students. Most of my students are actually graduate students, and so that, you know, maybe that can be another forum. but our focus here is to try to figure out, you know, what kinds of things that we've heard from our panelists, because I think everyone asked us to think about some very concrete strategies. Dr. Gandara, Elias, all of us have been sort of putting forth some ideas and suggestions. I wanted to actually give you all a chance to just chat with some folks around you, maybe someone right next to you, or you have a small group that you came with, to sort of brainstorm some ideas, because this faculty pledge was really meant to kind of sound out the alarm and also to ask my faculty colleagues in particular to step up to the plate and say, is there one small thing that each of us could commit to doing that would maybe change or enhance or enrich the educational experiences of our students, and ideally really make it more of a personal connection for them with us in understanding that we are deeply invested in their long-term and short-term success. But that's not unique or limited to faculty. So why don't we take a few minutes and just where you're seated, turn to someone and sort of, you know, consider the maybe you work with students, maybe you're part of a fraternity or sorority on campus or another student organization, MECHA or other organizations who might be represented here. Maybe you're a counselor, a staff member, or a teacher, or an administrator in our school system, but also see UC Davis as a strong resource for your campus community. Brainstorm some ideas about what would be one even small, minuscule thing. You see, I've directed it very closely to my colleagues because I know that, you know, even the slightest request can send us over the edge. So I did. Like, are you seriously kidding me? I'm busy. So everyone's busy, but you'll see that I had like different versions of from the big investment, which is like, I'm going to mentor a student into a research project, to, you know, I'm going to remember my students' names. Okay, so brainstorm some ideas given, you know, your own sort of scope of influence, and then I'll call us back together so we can think together about some additional questions we might have for the panelists, and then we'll bring that to a close. Okay? Let's take about 5 minutes. Oh, did we run out? Oh, I'm sorry. I made 80. I thought that would be enough.
Yes. 10% of their high schools. So they come here, they cannot all be 10% of their campus, right? They're not going to be top 10% here in Davis before they were. So it's a very, very traumatic experience for them to realize, oh, I didn't get an A in my calculus exam. In MIT, they realized this very early, that this is a very traumatic experience. And I think it is even worse for the Latinos because they come with additional maybe insecurity that, you know, there's not so many Latinos doing mathematics or science, so they come with an additional handicap. So, but then in MIT they realize that. So the first year they try to make classes all pass, no pass. So this is a very concrete thing that they have been trying to do to encourage students to fail. And because this is actually something that we don't have very clear in our culture to allow people to fail, that failing is okay. It's actually okay, and it's actually much better for you to fail and start again stronger rather than take a D and another D and another D, and then eventually it's too late. So this is essentially what the pattern of data that I have collected seems to indicate, that so many students maybe stagger from one D to the next, from one D to the next, and then eventually it's too late. They cannot recover for the, you know, accumulation of these to survive in a program of engineering or science. So these are some ideas, but I would love to hear experiences of people. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Very good. Yeah, go ahead, Rick. Quick, so I can get to some other ideas.
Because you touch on the whole issue of preparation, and from a community college perspective, and I didn't really talk about this, but especially with math, one of the things that I find with Latino students is really, I mean, it's the whole notion of encouraging them, because many Latino students that come to community colleges, they're not up there. They didn't do the A through G requirements. So usually they're starting off taking pre-algebra, intermediate algebra, and whatnot. So one of the things that we try to do is we really try to encourage them. And many of the students that are even thinking about doing something in math or science, they don't really know what that is. So a big part of what I do in my practice is to try to educate our students about what an engineer is, what you can do in math, science type of engineering type of programs, right? Because they hear about it, but they don't have a concrete idea about what that means. So, you know, from where I'm at in my practice, it's really critical to really help our students really conceptualize what that means in form of a major, and then encourage them that, yes, it's going to take a while to get to your Calc 3 and your differential equations, but it's staying on them, encouraging them, so...
That's Gloria, if I may, I wanted to ask the students, the undergraduates who are here, of those of you who are currently doing your undergraduate education now, how many of you could just self-reflect and realize there's that one student in your community that could have come to the Davis campus? Raise your hand if you could find somebody. And the reason I mention that, because this is a hybrid conversation that we're having about those students who could have come to this highly selective campus, those students who will persist in these type of engineering courses and whatnot, and the students' role in that process of engaging them to come to the Davis campus. Mm-hmm. Undergraduates are a critical vehicle that creates a momentum to engage them to seriously consider the Davis campus as one of those viable options. As part of undergraduate admissions, I want to extend and invite any undergraduate who's interested in calling any prospective student that is admitted in your regional community to commit to an hour, and we will have the resources for you to extend and be able to extend that new generation of cohort of students that will be entering our group. Because then this creates the network that we need to share the experiences of past, present, and future students who will be coming to our campus. And I could relate about the engineering. I did all those courses.
Yeah. Great. I think we had a couple of other ideas over here. Representative. Oh, hi, Rosa. Awesome. Okay.
Hi, I'm Maciel Hernandez. I'm a fifth-year graduate student in the Human Development Program, and my friend and colleague, Rosa Manso, is in the education, School of Education as well. We kind of were talking about mentoring for us graduate students who are interested in people like Montserrat to be in grad school, and kind of talking about the graduate experience and how we're kind of limited in time and energy to mentor you awesome undergrads, and maybe creating some sort of partnership that maybe not reinvent the wheel, but pull programs and share ideas about how to mentor undergrads in efficient ways. And we kind of came up with this pseudo idea about pseudo module about creating a database of graduate students and their research interests, so graduate students who are willing to mentor. But then we kind of questioned, oh, well, not everybody, you know, it's not our lab. How do we, you know, and how do we mentor undergraduates with the faculty support? And so that's kind of a question we have, because we're not faculty yet, and kind of dealing with those little details. But kind of maybe like graduate students being a mediator, mentor with the sponsorship of our advisors.
That's a great idea. And I think these are the opportunities that we have for really being able to connect with each other, too, to be able to see that there's a willingness to do that. among the grad students, and likewise, there's usually an unmet need among undergraduate students that want to learn more about, you know, what you all do and what keeps you guys going through that process that is distinct from what they hear from faculty, because all they hear from us is like, just come, you know, it'll be great, but it's not the same as, you know, really hearing the nitty-gritty from the grad students in the process. So my hope is that for folks in the room who are in a position to connect our graduate student community as mentors to the undergrads, that we can make that happen as well through these forums and through other follow-ups.
Gloria?
Was there another point? And then, yes.
Hi, I'm Susanna. I'm an undergraduate student.
Sorry,
I'm
okay.
Oh, no, sorry. You want to go?
Oh, I just want to make a comment. I think that's a wonderful idea, and I don't think as an undergrad we really need someone to, like, guide us, like, step by step. I think just by being there and, like, seeing Rosa and seeing you, I think that's more than enough, like, seeing you around and seeing that there's someone that's a grad student that looks like me. I mean, the first time I had you as a TA, I was shocked. In my psychology class, I was like, wow, this is the first time, besides my Chicano Latino classes, this is the first time in my psych major that I have a TA that looks like me. And I mean, I don't know if you remember that I would go to your office hours, and I feel like just seeing you there and like you taking interest in me meant a lot to me. So just like those little things, you don't, like, not being there and telling us what to do step by step, but just like committing to just like listening to us. And I don't know if you remember, but I asked you like a couple things about like your background, like knowing I wanted to learn more about you and learning that you were like me, that you came from a background similar to me, that made a difference. So I just wanted to let you know.
Yes.
Okay, I said, my name's Susanna, and I'm an undergraduate student here, major in sociology, and I also work at the Student Recruitment and Retention Center as an outreach coordinator. And actually, the group that we were in, all of us worked there, and we were talking about outreach and kind of how things that we do that seem to work. And we talked a lot about showing versus telling and how that's really important, and the difference. We kind of linked it back to like being active listeners and how as Latinos, like during our K through 12 and even like through community college, we're just kind of told just to listen, and we get all this information thrown at us, and we don't really know how it is that we're supposed to interact. And, you know, it's not just about like assuming that they know things, you know, but it's more about like showing them. Like we were talking about we were talking about how the first time we even heard like underrepresented was when we came to community college. And when you go out in outreach and you talk about underrepresented communities, or when we show these slides to K through 12 and there's this vocabulary out there, like underrepresented communities are marginalized, the students won't ask what that is. We can't, you know, they won't ask those vocabulary because I think we're stigmatized into thinking if I ask, it's assumed that I'm dumb, or it's, you know, and it's part of that community. So it's kind of like being active into asking them if you don't know something and pointing it out. And most of the time, they won't know what it is. And we also talked about, like you said, instead of reinventing the wheel, you know, just kind of working off programs that already exist. So, yeah, that's what we did.
Okay. Good. Was there someone else that I overlooked? Yes. I guess two people, Syria, and also we have another person back here.
Hi, my name is Siri Martinez, and I'm with the McNair Scholars Program. And what we talked about also in our group was, and I like that you guys mentioned about graduate school, because a lot of students don't think about graduate school. A lot of us, when I came to UC Davis also as an undergrad, and I didn't know that from here I can go on to graduate school. I knew that I was going to get through Davis, but I didn't know what I was doing next. So for those of you who are still wondering, we're in the Undergraduate Research Center. That's a great place to start, because they have people there in place to connect you and kind of help you navigate what is it, how do you find a mentor, how do you find a faculty mentor, how not to be afraid to approach them. So McNair is one program, but we have many programs. So I would say start with the Undergraduate Research Center and then go from there. So there are places here on campus that you can go to and try to figure out what do I do next. But definitely think about graduate school, period.
Word. Good. And then we had another comment back in the back, Maida. There you go. Mm-hmm. Or Alma. Thank you, Alma.
Hi, my name is Mary Vasquez. I work in the orientation program in student housing, which is a division of student affairs. I'm also an alumni of UC Davis, and so I think for me, what I try to pledge to do as a staff member on campus is to really infuse, especially in the orientation program, being that it's a campus-wide program, it serves like the predominant incoming first-year class and the transfer class, and programs such as STEP are not large enough to serve enough of underrepresented students, students of color, first-generation students. So something that I try to do with my staff, and being the only person of color on my staff, is trying to infuse, information about first-generation students, but how are we then taking orientation and, ensuring that first-generation students' needs are met? For me, especially the family program, what you mentioned, that we make a huge assumption that family members that come to the orientation program have a basic understanding or knowledge or vocabulary that we can all speak about the research university, about UC Davis. So really trying to infuse that into my professional career, but even within orientation. But it's a challenge. I struggle with it on a daily basis. And so, seeing other Chicano Latino staff members here, how do you infuse that in a student affairs program that one is supposed to meet the needs of all students and obviously doesn't?
Yeah, actually, that's perfect, Julie, because I actually wanted to ask our panelists, and we'll start with you, Julie, okay. But I'm going to ask you each to take a couple minutes to sort of respond to now what you're hearing. And
okay. Yeah. So, Mary, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that we do in ethnic studies at my Sacramento State campus, we actually have a service learning program. And one of the things that we work with Wilsonwood Middle School and Hiram Johnson High School, but one of the things we discovered is how do we translate this information? How do we create access? Every spring, we invite about 100 parents. And one of the things that I so appreciated, this is where school leaders, right, those of your school leaders, the school leadership at Wilsey Wood, used to be this principal named Jim Wong, and what he did is he wrote a grant, and the first thing he purchased with that grant were, not rocket science, translation devices. Easiest thing. Hmong parents turn to Channel 6, Spanish-speaking parents turn to Channel 2, and that's what we do. So they get to ask and feel included. And everybody's, does that make sense? So I don't know if there's that possibility of buying translation devices. But we also incorporate students' organizations to come and interact with our parents, right? So some of our parents don't know if they have to buy textbooks. What if their kids can't afford a computer? We got a 24-hour computer lab. So we really try to work in partnership with student, with the parents and students year-round. Right, so we keep that dialogue going. We've gone so far as there are emblems now painted on the school. Does that make sense? There's college, so it's a very threaded experience for them, as much as it is for our college students.
Rick? Closing thought? Timo?
On any of these comments?
Yeah, I just wanted to give our panelists, the opportunity for another thought or two, and then just a quick follow-up so we can close.
In one key element that students don't necessarily have access to is to experience the campus life. I think the traditional student has access to learning about the college, the universities, and the options that they have available, but the typical non-student whose parents did not pursue an education, when they try to access the university, they're trying to get more the in-depth of how they could develop that family relationship at the institution. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I've suggested to individuals is, especially colleges, departments, and units, and research areas, that the nomenclature that exists in higher ed within the low-income and first-generation college students, it's all brand new. You mentioned simple terms that we would consider like entomology. It's a brand new world to them. But when you translate it to prospective students as, hey, you're going to learn about bugs, you can even cook and eat them, it creates a whole new world of creativity and an innovation in that process. I think what's key is that we have to go beyond our typical scopes of how we do our work and begin to see those. And I love the term that was used earlier, very radical and extreme ways of shocking people, so it could get the attention and people could explore additional venues of information. But outreach, in my opinion, regardless of how it's delivered, it's critical to ensuring that students have access to what they will need in order for them to be successful. Even though I'm here representing the University of California undergraduate admissions, I think it's critical, regardless, that we provide students with the information for them to be successful to graduate and get their degree. Because I think our overall goal is the concern of what's going on in California. They need to get their degree. And I definitely don't want them to blame me as to why they did not graduate from here. I want to ensure that I give them the credible information in order for them to be successful at this institution.
I want to add another thing here. I also teach a college success class at American River College with a Chicano Latino focus. One of the things I really instill with students, especially at the community college, since community college kind of has a stigma of being like second class. I always call it, well, we're second chance. And it is. One of the things that I really instill in my students and really, really push them is that they're already at the university. And oftentimes students kind of think like, well, I'm at a community college and I'm at a different level. And I always hear this all the time. The community college is at one level and the university is at another. It's not a level. You're already lower division students. And part of that whole thing is, you know, some people call this a transfer culture. I think transfer culture starts from within with how you practice. And I really try to instill that, being at UC for 5 years prior to being at ARC. But a big thing, too, is that, you know, what's really important for our Raza students is for them to really conceptualize that whole notion that they are legitimate university students by virtue of taking transferable coursework. And yeah, you're not in a big lecture tank of 300 students, but you're in a classroom of 35 students, and you're being taught by a faculty member whose sole purpose is to teach and interact. So when I look at that, and when I think about how we can help our students really move on and make that transition, and of course, you know, there's the course requirements that you need to transfer, but there's also that sense of knowing that, yes, I am a university student. I don't know where I'm going to go, but it's really trying to instill that. And, you know, I'm going to reflect, too, about the whole mentoring thing, especially with graduate school. I think the whole mentoring starts with the person, with the individual, with sharing our own personal experiences. And I tell students, it's like, go reach out to your faculty member. Ask them questions about their own personal experiences. We love to talk about ourselves, right? And I think those personal interactions, I think, are critical, and especially when, you know, we try to connect our students with Latino faculty. I mean, it's huge. It's significant. These are just thoughts, just as I resonate, as I hear about this thing. So part of the thing that we try to do at the community college is just to really reinforce that you are here and you are university students, and then that validates their experience and their decision to be there with us.
Montserrat, I'll go ahead and give you the last word then.
I don't know. It just makes me really happy that people are learning that we are visible in the community and we are important. And I'm glad that you're representing student housing today and you are here because, I mean, when I was in my staff as an RA, I was one of 10 in my staff and I felt really out of place. And I'm glad that you're going to take back those suggestions and integrate it and like make us feel part of the community because we are here. And I mean, the stats just say that there's going to be more of us here. So I'm glad that everybody attended and was very active, was participating. So I'm really happy.
Thank you. And so likewise with that, I'll add my thanks to everyone who came. I know some people are from units, you know, across campus, and I really appreciate faculty, colleagues. Patricia, once again, thank you so much for setting the tone and that sense of urgency that we all share, but now having additional evidence to be able to work with. What I will pledge to do, in addition to some of the things that you see listed here that I do as a faculty member, is to actually work with Elias to follow up with folks and to find ways to monitor what our promises are and to come back together throughout, you know, the rest of the year and to sort of see what kind of progress we can make and how we can make that tangible for other people who are concerned but are not in a position necessarily to be able to support this process at this point, could be educated more through our efforts. So thank you all. And I don't know if our organizers had any other things they'd like to add, but thank you all. Thanks to all of our supporters who recorded this for other people. And